看来我们只能靠自己了。
地球错失了最后一线机会。
这座公共不是庇护所。
我觉得旁边的二货人哪辆几分鱼的毛病。
Hi everyone and welcome to Middle Earth, your source for insight into China cultural industry. How the cultural business works in that part of the world told by the one who won the trenches of creation, production and distribution. I'm your host, Aladin Faré from CCP, China Compass Production, your film service production in the Middle Kingdom. And this show is a member of the Cineca Network. I'm glad to announce that this episode is sponsored by OVTV, a streaming platform focused on independent feature film, animation and docs that are usually unavailable on any other platforms. And this sponsors this episode by giving 10 fans of Middle Earth a free month where you could watch over 800 films. So every title is around 90 minutes, so you can in theory binge half of their catalog. And they got a lot of great film from China, of title of Jia Jiangke and Wang Bing. So all you got to do to get that 3 months of unlimited film is to share among our 38 episodes your favorite Middle Earth podcast episode on your social media, Twitter, Facebook, WeChat Moment, you name it. Take a screenshot, send it to me before the 10th of September. You can find me easily on the podcast link description. Then we'll do a small lottery for the ones who did it. Also, another announcement. Yes, we got a lot of those, but I promise you the episode is starting soon. But especially if you're in Shanghai, Chengdu, or Berlin at the end of August, early September, you might want to hear about it. For its third edition, the WISE Festival will happen and bring knowledgeable conference during the day and cool concert at night. So if you're into music, art, and new technology, you should check the link of the festival on the podcast description and see their lineup. Also, SubChina will soon release a 20% off promo code. Now, on with the show. Just a few days ago, a report and a book compiled what we have known for years regarding the influence on Beijing cultural regulation on foreign film, but this time in more lengthy details. Because in case you don't know, yes, in order to sell movie tickets to the growing number of Chinese moviegoers, Hollywood studios had to make adjustments to storyline that they were not doing before. I'm glad to have the two authors of those report, Chris Fenton and James Tager, who are both in LA while I'm in the office in Beijing, so maybe you will hear like people in the background. Chris Fenton, you have led for 17 years the multi-million dollar global media company DMG Entertainment Motion Picture Group based in Beijing and its North American branch. There you have produced or supervised 21 films grossing $2 billion in world box office. And based on that experience, you just finished a book, Feeding the Dragon, Inside the Trillion Dollar Dilemma Facing Hollywood, the NBA and American Business. And at present, you advise regularly as a China expert, serve as a CEO of Media Capital Technology, and you are a contributor for various media.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
And James Tager, you have a background in law, and you are now a deputy director of Free Expression Research and Policy at PEN America. It's a US NGO that since 1922 focuses on literature and human rights to protect free expression in the United States and worldwide. Okay, so you guys were founded 1 year after the CCP. What a great date. And you are the primary author of the report Made in Hollywood, Censored by Beijing, which is not your first research on the topic. At PEN America, you have spearheaded major advocacy campaign on freedom of expression in China and engaged in individual case for dozens of imprisoned Chinese writer and artist.
That's me. Thank you for having me, Alan.
We will first talk about the origin on Hollywood and some companies decided to go down that rabbit hole. All the studios had to make tough choices and what can we expect for the future. And after this conversation, we'll finish with the usual recommendation of our guest and the quiz. I guess we should maybe go back in time and start by how things started in the beginning, because I don't think in the 90s and all the movies that I saw when growing up, like the question of will Chinese censors will influence this movie was not at all a question back in that day.
So I started working with DMG around the turn of the century in the year 2000. At that point, the movie business inside the China borders was not very big. In fact, it really wasn't much on radar for Hollywood. They obviously knew it would be big. And of course, James talked about 1997 and a lot of the issues the studios had with several movies that ruffled some feathers of the CCP. So everybody knew at some point it would be a big viable business, but at the turn of the century, it was not. When it actually started to percolate into somewhat of a business was right after the 2008 Beijing Olympics. After the Olympics had concluded, I think everybody wiped their brow in China and said, wow, I'm glad we pulled that one off. What's next? And the, you know, the CCP put together mandates in regards to various industries that they wanted to grow into world-class industries. One of them happened to be the film industry. And by the beginning of 2009, they had gotten about 5,000 screens online. Obviously, today, there's more than 70,000 screens. So that's how quick the market grew in regards to infrastructure. And obviously, box office grew with that same sort of scalability. So I would say 2009 was when we really started to pay attention to the movie business.
Yeah, Chris mentioned 1997 is an important year, and I want to elaborate on that. We describe in our Pen America report the year 1997 as the high watermark for studio movies being willing to criticize China. Three films came out that year, Kundun, 7 Years in Tibet, and Red Corner, that either talked about, in some ways, Chinese policy in Tibet or about the Chinese legal system. None of these films were released in China, despite the fact that they were major Hollywood productions. But more importantly, Beijing essentially sent out this very powerful message. They went on the offensive and they blacklisted these studios from doing business in China for several years, and also put forward this blacklist of people who worked on the films. And so the next year, it was Michael Eisner of Disney, the CEO of Disney, actually sort of apologized for Kundun, saying, well, the bad news is that we made the film, but the good news is that nobody watched it. And so we point to that as a really pivotal year for the Hollywood-China relationship, because that was the year that Beijing put Hollywood studios on notice that they would be willing to essentially punish studios at large if the studios made a film that the CCP saw as, you know, critical of them or of their ideology or regulations or policy. I mean, we had one person tell us for the report that they ended their point by saying, well, we're not making 7 Years in Tibet. And so that year and these movies have sort of become watchwords for where Hollywood was 23 years ago, juxtaposed to where Hollywood is now.
That 1997 moment was watershed also, because it was that great, I guess, a canary in a coal mine moment, because there wasn't much, as I mentioned, there wasn't much of a business there, and no one even cared about those movies getting in. But when they saw the ramifications of what occurred in regards to retaliation, everybody sort of really woke up and they said, okay, well, thank God it's not a big market right now, but at some point it will be. So there was a lot of trial and error put in probably between 1997 and 2008 in regards to how to prepare censorship-wise, soft power-wise, avoiding antagonism-wise, in regards to all content that was made at the studios, so that when that day did come, when China became a viable market and China also became a viable investor in Hollywood, everybody would have learned all the essentially China 101 rules by that point. The one company, and I was just on a show recently where somebody asked if Hollywood could survive without China, and my answer pretty much is a blanket no, with the exception of a company, for instance, like Netflix, where they for years tried to get into that market. They weren't successful. And competitors of theirs that are Chinese have taken over that market. So the idea of Netflix not ever getting in that market is probably pretty practical and realistic. So you're actually seeing Netflix take chances with content that no other studio would touch. For instance, last year they did a documentary that they put out called One Child Nation. That would be a documentary that no other studio would even touch, even if it was through one of its like subdivisions.
I agree with that.
So yeah, I know that it was incredibly hard for Pen America to find people willing to talk in front of a mic regarding the whole issue. But as you guys know, the Middle Earth podcast were incredibly resourceful, and we managed to record the process of writing the script that will go to China.
This is so awesome, you guys. Our band is going to be huge. Yeah, isn't it just great? Hey, what's wrong, Jimmy? Fellas, I need to tell you something. I think I'm homosexual. And also, I'm addicted to cocaine.
Oh, that's okay, Jimmy.
Yeah, we can get you a liver transplant.
Cut! Cut!
Listen, guys, we just got word back from the Chinese censors. They don't want us mentioning organ transplants.
How come?
Well, they've been accused of harvesting organs from the... Look, it doesn't matter. They just said no to the organ stuff. Oh, and no homosexuality either.
No homosexuality? We're trying to do a band biopic.
Yeah, and what's wrong with homosexuality anyways?
Nothing, unless you want to make money in China. Now, come on, everyone back to one.
Did South Park get it right? Does it really happen like this, or is it a bit more nuanced?
One of the things I really like about the South Park example, which obviously the example itself is fictional, but in the example, they talk about, well, gee, it's a reference to, I think it was, to an organ transplant, and that is kiboshed in the South Park episode. And one of the things I think that points to that I think is correct is the idea that for the average person reflecting on what Chinese censorship looks like, they probably think most about the big political ideas, you know, Tibet, Tiananmen, and Taiwan, the three T's, as it's commonly referred to. But in our report, we talk about some of the different ways that that the Chinese censorship strictures have affected Hollywood in ways that are not intuitively political. For example, Beijing's restriction on tropes like time travel or ghost stories. Ghost stories is a really interesting one. We had one person say to us that Chinese censorship was, as they saw it, the reason why no one would ever remake the ghost movie with Demi Moore. And one of the most interesting things about that prohibition, which is kind of shaping the way that Hollywood decides what tropes and what genres of film it wants to explore, is that Chinese commentators will explain how the folkloric traditions of Chinese ghost stories often were political commentary. So something that doesn't seem to us to be political or doesn't seem to us to fall within these bright red lines of what Beijing wants to keep out of its movies, there still may be Chinese censorship pressures on Hollywood to comply with things that are not really intuitive to the average, at least the average Westerner.
The undead, the spirit, the ghost world created a lot of problems for Lionsgate with their franchise Twilight, because Twilight was based on the undead in the form of vampires. So after we had gotten an Alex Proyas movie called Knowing In, which had various sort of supernatural elements to it, Lionsgate asked us to help them with Twilight. We had to convince them that we would cut enough of the undead out of it so that it essentially really wasn't much of a vampire movie anymore. And we would market and promote the movie to its populace via the idea of this forbidden love Romeo and Juliet movie that was akin to one of the most beloved Hollywood movies of all time in that country, which was Titanic. So we completely spun the idea to the CCP that the idea of any sort of reference to vampire, undead, or that kind of mythology would be completely whitewashed from anything that we did in regards to engaging their consumer interest. And they ultimately allowed us to get the movie in. And then in the version of time travel, the movie Looper that we did had time travel. And not only did it have time travel, which is censored enough as is, because typically it involves going in the past, but this was future time travel. And the CCP is extremely careful about the story and narrative of where China's going in the future, just as much as where China was in the past. That was a very, very difficult process to get through in order to get through the censorship exemption of letting something in that did have time travel in it.
Yeah, because you're saying like some things are not allowed to be showed. But then I'm wondering what is like the room, like how can you negotiate things? Because yeah, you say like time travel is not possible, but The Avenger, the last film, is fully based on that. And the same thing, No Magic, but Harry Potter was screened here. It feels to me that when the thing is like really big, then people will let film get in and be a little bit, give a little bit more of a slack, because there is like so much incentive to have so many people buying tickets.
That's part of it. I mean, I think with Looper, we displayed the idea that all time travel in the future and the past either may not even involve China narrative or messaging, or you could actually promote China messaging through it. In the case of Looper, we created the future of where all the characters in that movie wanted to be was in China. And why did they want to be in China? Because China was the center of the world in 40 years. We really showcased the fact that time travel, if done right, can carry out very strong messaging on behalf of the CCP. And then, and on top of it, I think through that process and maybe a handful of other movies that tried to get in with time travel issues, the CCP was able to see that there were definitely certain movies, i.e. the Avengers movie, that really didn't involve anything China in terms of the time travel. So if people want to see that movie and they know that the people want to see that movie, they can let certain exemptions happen. But it's always a very fluid process. I mean, there's an attempt to understand what all the rules are, but the rules are extremely pliable and bendable depending on who you're talking to at the CCP and what the temperament is at that given time based on the climate geopolitically or just the relationship that that particular studio or filmmaker has with the CCP at that given moment.
Chinese censorship model is very dynamic, as Chris said, fluid. And one of the most interesting things about Chris's book is his ability to kind of give us a peek inside that system. To Chris's credit, I think that Chris grapples with what that means, which is that on some level, you're really granting through this dynamic fluid process, you're granting power to the censor to influence this final product, not merely by saying remove this, remove that, but shaping the actual product of the movie. And we talk about in the report how this is consistent with Beijing's overall goals, which is that they see see films not merely as a medium for entertainment, but through the lens of political messaging. And so if they overall determine that the political messaging of the film is a win for them, then they're far more likely to greenlight it.
What's interesting to me as somebody that's a squeaky wheel in this and trying to voice this problem in regards to Hollywood, but not just Hollywood, it carries obviously into the NBA, it carries into Starbucks and Apple and various other issues that we have with all industries, right, is there are exceptions we can make, things that we can live with as Americans that I'm okay with in order to find solutions on how to find a path forward. Because in your report, you said a full decoupling for Hollywood or even America with China is just unrealistic. It's impractical. Right. And it's not even in our best interest. Right. So knowing that, what is a way we can move forward with China and feel okay about it? And just one little box to check for me is I'm okay with a finished product being censored to get into that market, because we're okay with it when it comes to Japan or when it comes to Korea or when it comes to the Middle East. But where I have problems is outside of their borders. When they're trying to influence us on that content for what the rest of the world can see or even Americans can see, that treads on our free speech rights and our creative freedoms, and it's pushing their soft power narrative beyond their borders. And they can't even hide behind the fact that, oh, well, if our populace sees that, it might create an uprising and that's bad for us. And I get that that's a terrible argument to make anyway, but they can't even make that argument because they can firewall anything that's outside of their country from most of their populace. So to say, oh, they're going to see that Taiwanese flag when it plays in Argentina, the latest Top Gun movie I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you can keep your own populace from seeing it, just like we would censor it when it goes into your market. So stop pushing your narrative, your soft power political agenda, your propaganda beyond your borders. You can do what you want inside, but you can't do what you want outside.
I think that, for our report, we came to some similar conclusions to much of what you just said. We talk about how we're clear-eyed about the fact that there are substantial economic incentives for Hollywood to comply with the system. And furthermore, we really don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater of cutting off intercultural communication in order to resist censorship. We are actually, we're a cultural organization, Pan America. But we talk about from the international perspective of the fact that Hollywood, beyond just being an American filmmaking industry, it's really kind of one of, it's the most prominent global center for filmmaking. And so if we reduce the stories that global audiences are able to access in order to please Beijing and its strict comprehensive censorship system, we're really doing a disservice to everyone, and we're cutting the stories we tell down to a lowest common denominator. And that's why one of the key recommendations we end with in our report is a pledge from Hollywood as an industry, Hollywood studios industry-wide, to pledge not to comply with Chinese censorship to the extent that they changed the worldwide release of the films they're putting out.
And so, did anybody respond to that?
The studios and the MPA either did not respond on the record or declined to respond.
And by the way, that's my biggest, and I'm a squeaky wheel in this, and I'm calling people out because we need this, like this third rail issue is just so ridiculous, we got to stop. But at the same point, in order to get it out in the open, there's got to be a leverage of unified players in this. So one place that I'm still upset about from even the SEC Foreign Corrupt Practices Act investigation that overtook Hollywood back in 2012 is that their association, the MPAA or the MPA, did not come out and say, hey, we're going to take the lead on this. We're going to explain to regulators and Congress how that market works and the way it operates. So the SEC needs to look at that market differently than perhaps they do in Mexico or in other places. But the MPAA went completely silent. And I talk about that in the book. It's crazy to me. And this is another situation where the MPA could come out in front and say, we are not talking on behalf of any individual studio. We are talking on behalf of Hollywood itself. So if you want to retaliate, you're retaliating against all of Hollywood. And that's going to be a problem because we know your consumers want that product in there. Maybe not one studio. Maybe one studio can be eliminated from your market and things will be okay. But if all of Hollywood is out, then you guys have a problem, CCP. So we are going to address this in numbers, in unity, on behalf of all of them. And that's how this moves forward. I don't understand how they're sitting in, you know, this with their heads in the sand on this thing. Act like an association and get out there and be an advocate.
Port, we similarly say that the MPA could and should take leadership on this issue. I totally agree that what is needed is unified action from Hollywood and as an industry. And if we expect studios to address it piecemeal, then I think Chris is right that ultimately that will allow Beijing to basically punish one studio at a time and just further chill the industry. Whereas unified action from the industry at large, and more specifically with the big five studios and the MPA, which represents them plus Netflix, I think is the right way to go. And certainly we need a more public conversation about this. We talk about how censorship and self-censorship thrives in obscurity, and sunlight remains a very powerful disinfectant. And right now we're having this sort of iterative conversation where it pops up every once in a while. You'll see a new article with new information about it every several months. And then it seems like Hollywood as an industry just kind of hopes this issue will go away. But I think audiences across the globe are more concerned about this. Certainly, we've seen legislators and administration officials demonstrate their concerns. And the trends, we believe, will make this issue worse for Hollywood, not better. As China's economic box office grows, the leverage that Beijing can apply to these studios will only increase. So we believe now is the time for industry on its own to take leadership on this issue.
Okay, then after all you've said, like, which ties up a little bit on the next question, and maybe it gives like maybe an element of answers regarding why not all the studios kind of make a united front. But then what about like companies who invest in American film and then go on and win Oscar? How does that change the dynamic?
Well, the investment in Hollywood was obviously one that was massively abundant. Obviously, we were involved in financing a lot of movies in the 2011 to 2017-18 point. I would say probably the peak was around 2016, just as Wanda was purchasing the last piece of the AMC puzzle, which was Carmike. And then obviously they went in and bought Legendary Studios. Almost every studio at that time had some sort of Chinese partial financing of their film slates. But a lot of that has been mitigated over time to the point where even Tencent and Alibaba are just doing one picture at a time. So the studios have been weaned off of that quite a bit just through, you know, the geopolitical issues between China and the U.S. and CFIUS has gotten involved, et cetera. So I think Hollywood can survive without that China investment in the movies, but Hollywood still needs that market. That market is massively important for the ROIs of these huge, huge capital expenditures.
The issue of sort of financing from Chinese financiers, either private or state-owned, is interesting because we talk about the fact in the report, you know, some people think of this as just another example of studio politics. You know, the financiers may always feel like they can kind of insert their ideas and notes, et cetera. And certainly we don't want to rule financing out merely because of its country of origin. We talk about, however, the fact that, you know, in these situations, Chinese financiers, they do operate under a system of centralized state control, and they have their own relationships with Beijing to manage. Now, China's not the only country where financing from corporations connected to the government could raise alarm bells. And we talk about in the report, another example is the Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and his sort of charm offensive of Hollywood in 2018 with Saudi government connected financing. And we actually note that the fact that China's not alone in exercising this influence actually underscores the need for Hollywood players to have an honest conversation about the power that their financial backers may have over the film's content, particularly if those backers back home have kind of relationships with the censors of their own to deal with. And ultimately, the reason why we talk about Chinese financing in the report is because essentially no other foreign financing partner is as well placed to push for movie changes as these Chinese firms, because no other nation's box office is as critical to Hollywood's success as China's.
That last point you brought up, which is China's really the exception in terms of having real leverage, is 100% the case, because pre-Khashoggi, I was in talks to be involved with the Saudi Arabian initiative to invest in Hollywood. They really wanted to replicate a lot of the model that we applied to China to help build their own film industry. And what was interesting is some of the push that they wanted to make in exchange for their money, I found was trying to grasp for too much. And the reason for that is, yes, their money was important to Hollywood, but their market really wasn't. China has a double whammy. They have the perfect storm of leverage, which is at one point they were bringing money in to finance what was very risky plays, big budget movies. And on the other end, they were showcasing the fact that they were going to have the biggest market in the world starting next year, where the ROI on these huge capital expenditures were reliant completely on that market.
Chris, in an interview for The Epoch Time, you explained that if you want to have access to this market, you need to shoot the movie there and you have to hire a Chinese crew. So now I'm wondering, like, what is the border between like censor and like overzealous co-producer? Because you talked about Looper, and I discovered thanks to your book that actually the story was supposed to happen in Paris. I'm from Paris. I'm really sad that now it was being shot in Shanghai.
There's two sort of, it's bifurcated in regards to the product that we're talking about. If we're talking about a movie, there's the finished cut of the movie, which you simply are trying to get into the market. And that's something where there's obviously premeditated censorship in making that particular movie, but you're making the movie for the global audience and you're thinking, hey, if we just make the vanilla version of this film, don't even think about China, but just try not to antagonize China in the movie, finish it and then try to get it into the market, there's that pitch to the CCP, which is, hey, here's this movie. It's great. It's big. It's non-threatening to you. It's not antagonistic. It doesn't cover anything censorship-wise. Will you please let it in? We're happy to cut whatever you want, cut out of it if you think there's things that you want out. That's one version of getting the product in and the kind of product. The product that Looper was, that category, is one where you actually are going out of your way to take a movie in its script phase and tailor relevancy for China into the movie itself. It's using one of our artists, Summer Ching, as a lead opposite Bruce Willis as his wife. It's showcasing China in the story of the movie, creating extra relevancy. But then on top of it, the movie's shooting on the ground in China, and there's a skill set exchange, which is creating jobs, creating middle class expertise that's going to build our film industry and ultimately bring more people into the middle class in our country, which satisfies major objectives for the CCP overall. That allowed us way more wind to the back in getting the movie in, getting the movie, and this is something that the Pen America report talks about. It's not just getting the movie in, it's when is the movie released? We got to release the movie day and date with the rest of the world. That's very difficult to pull off, at least back then in 2012, especially since that day and date release fell on a national holiday where all U.S. movies are blackballed to allow local films to get their share of the box office. They actually designated the film as a local production to get that release date. And then they gave us, I think it was 6 months of advance marketing and promotion for that date so that we could get as many people excited about the movie prior to its release.
Chris highlights several really important points in that. I mean, number one is that the Beijing censor offers both a carrot and a stick. And again, this contrasts with what I think the average person thinks of when they think of the censor. They think of the censor just, you know, erasing certain passages or mandating removals, but they don't think about the censor actually encouraging the inclusion of content that they see as deliberately sort of flattering to their political message. And they don't think about the way that in this situation, as Chris was just talking about, Beijing may hold out incentives for studios to essentially more actively cooperate with this system. Looper was an example of a joint production. We kind of walk through some of our specific concerns with joint production specifically in our report. And we talk about that we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We applaud international collaboration between filmmakers across different countries, cultures, and communities. That's a net positive. The issue is that joint productions as a model essentially bake in a studio's acquiescence to censorship for the duration of the project, you know, essentially ceding more ground to Chinese censors who are very willing to kind of incorporate essentially their specific political messages. And Chris just talked about the Looper experience, which he, of course, elaborates on in his book, and we discuss as well in our report. But another example would be that I think is just as, if not more famous, is Transformers Age of Extinction, one of the Transformers movies, which started as a joint production, and then I believe Paramount exited out of the joint production model. But a lot of observers talked about how the film paints American officials kind of unflatteringly while playing up the selflessness of Chinese officials, particularly in their willingness to sort of defend Hong Kong from this fictional alien threat. And this was a film that was released at around the same time as the umbrella movement in Hong Kong, the protest calling for greater democratic freedom. So is that political messaging is essentially very in your face. And it's an example of how the joint censorship model, while we applaud filmmakers working together, our concern comes from when the censor is essentially invited in through the front door.
One of the things that I tried to display in my book was there were so many antagonists. Like, it was, I sort of visualize it when I think about the stories that I was telling there, as you had like Zeus and Poseidon, or the dragon and the eagle up in the clouds fighting each other with lightning bolts and spears and everything way up in the heavens. And then you had this cast of characters, myself and all of my colleagues, either from the US side or the Chinese side, and the crews that were part of the Marvel team or part of the Sony team or part of, the team of below the line in China. And all this stuff was clashing above our heads in the heavens, right? Like critics, regulators, journalists, leaders, all the different forces. Yet these characters that were making the movie were just trying to make a movie. We were just trying to get a job done. And a lot of us had really different perspectives on the world. We came from different places. We had lots of differences. But in that process, that battle test, we got closer, we collaborated, and we saw eye to eye. And that throw baby out with the bathwater line that James used so rightfully is something we don't want to get rid of. Like, that cultural exchange, and that cultural exchange does create commerce, and there's big money to make in that market. But that cultural exchange is part of the glue that will keep these superpowers from entering a cold war or worse.
Well, that's just perfect, because I wanted to ask you, what about the future? And is there any silver lining in this whole situation?
Certainly for us, as a freedom of expression oriented organization that includes this mandate to encourage cultural interchange, we don't think this should be looked at as from the perspective of kind of US versus China. And we don't want to have it be an excuse for political grandstanding or ratcheting up tensions unnecessarily. Our perspective is from the perspective of how do we promote freedom of expression for artists and filmmakers, and how do we make sure that the movies that people consume across the world is as free from sort of political or censorious influence as possible. And we actually talk about in the report how we're not naive to the fact that Hollywood has been an instrument for American soft power for years and decades. But of course, the United States does not have a centralized censorship system in the way that China does. And furthermore, we talk about in the report how the trade group, the MPA, how they have been very willing to push back against U.S. government efforts that they see as censorious, and how Hollywood enjoys this reputation of speaking truth to power in the U.S. And we applaud that. What we want is for that to be globalized. We want Hollywood to rightfully enjoy a reputation for speaking truth to power against any government and in anywhere in the world. And that's ultimately what we're calling for. I don't know if that answers your question of what's in the future, but that's certainly our vision.
I've seen the magic or the power of cultural and commercial exchange. And perhaps this marriage has too many things flawed with it in order to stay married. But we've entangled ourselves so much between the US and China that it's like we have all these children, right? And I think we should get divorced, but we have worked together really well at times in the commercial and cultural exchange. And I've seen the glue that creates and the magic that creates. We help them build what they are today as an economy, the same way Europe helped the United States build what we created at the turn of the 18th century. And a lot of the tactics China uses that we're upset about, we used against Europe back then. But now we need to do what Europe did to us, which is call us out and say, enough is enough. And I know we're talking about just censorship, but let's throw censorship in just the fair trade model, which is, hey, in the microcosm of Hollywood, enough is enough with 25 cents of every dollar coming back to the studios. Get it up to the global norm of 45% to 50%. Enough with quotas of 34 films for all the world. Like, that's not even Hollywood. It's just 34 movies overall. Enough with your cross-border censorship issues. That's got to stop. But once we get through those growing pains, once we get through the divorce, we're going to have one of those great sort of working post-divorce relationships where all the children grow up well because the two parents, even though they're not married anymore, are actually getting along in some sort of strategic competitor relationship. But that's sort of the way we need to look at this. And we need to check boxes one by one. It is a piecemeal, like baby step approach towards that utopian reset that we might not ever get to, but we can get close to. But the only way we're going to do it is to do what PEN America did, what I'm doing as a squeaky wheel, what others are doing as squeaky wheels, and to get everybody out of the sand and put their heads up and say, okay, we need to work on this together, but keeping it quiet and doing, it drove me nuts when I read James's report and I saw all these people that were willing to speak off the record or not be attributed or kept anonymous or even people that wouldn't even pick up the phone. And I know from Stan Rosen and that USC event you guys had recently, you guys couldn't find anybody to speak on the on the record or be at that event. And it drives me crazy. And the best thing, by the way, I love the fact is you guys had case studies that are in my book, but I didn't have anything to do with the PEN America report. So it's two completely separate squeaky wheels that have a Venn diagram that's completely symbiotic and carrying the same message. And I know there's others that will carry that same influence, and we can get this done.
You know, one thing that where I feel like Chris and I strongly agree is this: we need to talk about it concept, right? This is an issue that will not get solved if it's only discussed behind closed doors, or if Hollywood insiders just kind of continue to hope that the issue sort of fades from view and just try to ride it out. We need public and unified action from Hollywood. I think of a previous report that that PEN America did was on social media censorship in China. And a conversation that I, in some ways, I see is related to this conversation is for social media companies, Western social media companies, thinking about going back into China or digital companies. So, for example, when Google was considering Project Dragonfly, which was its censored Chinese language search engine that I was thinking about launching. And broadly, a lot of the conversation in defense of these ideas has been, well, gee, you know, if a non-Chinese business sort of enters the market, aren't we actually expanding the scope of what's being said and what access Chinese people have information to, et cetera? But the answer, if the company is actually actively complying with Beijing censorship stricture, the answer is no. And I think that kind of boils down some of the pressures here. I mean, cultural mediums and cultural products like movies are incredibly powerful ways of invoking ideas, of communicating ideas, of speaking truth to power, of riling people into considering social or political or cultural issues of the day that they should be kind of thinking about and discussing, but not if there isn't some kind of pushback against the censor.
The both of you have been having a lot of wishful thinking, but what do you think will really happen?
I think China is in certain ways is like a teenager that is testing limits of the parents. The fact of the matter is we've seen what happens when the parent does push back. And I'll give the example of today. Wolf warrior diplomacy, that is something that seemed to be a very strong directive starting several months ago. I think not only did the U.S. start to push back on that, but also Australia. Several countries in the European Union did too. And if you've noticed, and it hasn't been headlined in the Global Times or whatever, but I would argue that wolf warrior diplomacy has sort of started to disappear. If there is pushback, the Chinese are practical. They realize maybe they went too far with that initiative, and who knows, maybe it shows back up again tomorrow and we'll see me proved wrong. But I think it's pretty interesting to see what happens when the leverage of multiple parties started to push back against one of their tactics, you started to see it disappear. And that's what I think will happen if we can get our collective, you know, mojo together as a country, as industries, as companies, as filmmakers, as celebrities, as political leaders, and just say, no, we're not going to put up with this.
Chris made a really important point, and it relates to some of the things we've said in this conversation about China's censorship model being so dynamic. There is a specific agenda behind it, and because it is so dynamic, you know, the censor will push for more and more. That's how the system has been set up, where they will push to have these ideas of theirs that they want present in Hollywood movies more and more present and mainlined into the Hollywood filmmaking process, which indeed does mean that if you do not say we are drawing the line here, then the line will be drawn for you and it will be redrawn and redrawn to cut away more artistic freedom from filmmakers rather than less.
I just got one last question. It's more like a bad cop, why did you not burn the tape kind of question to both of you. Each one will get their own take on that. We'll start with Chris. You work with that system for years, and now you're writing a book about what you went through. As Jim's report mentioned, like, you are sharing information that no one else wants to do on the record. I'm just wondering, like, what pushed you to write this book? Are you looking for redemption in some way?
You know what? I started the book well before I even understood what I was complicit in. I still feel really stupid about it. I mean, over the years, I had various people chirp in my ears, whether it was executives, family members, and definitely my wife. And in fact, in the book, I have her quite often sort of chirping in my ear about, are you okay with doing that? Is that something that feels American? Are we compromising? Are you kowtowing? Whatever it was. And I was under this mission of globalism and this idea of opening the market no matter what the cost. And I never really thought about what the long-term ramifications of that were. And I actually started writing the book well before I thought that I was doing anything wrong. And by the way, I was just a cog in the wheel. It wasn't like it was all me. But I was definitely in the center of a lot of the cogs in the wheel that were doing this, that ultimately caused us to be complicit. And it wasn't until Daryl Morey of the Houston Rockets, the GM, tweeted out his support for Hong Kong. And I saw exactly what I predicted after that tweet, which was retaliation on the China side for it. That was not a surprise. The surprise to me was the woke moment that occurred in the United States of America about what the NBA was staying quiet on, or unprepared they were to address that crisis. And it's when I started to look back over my career and realized, oh my God, I'm just as much to blame as the NBA or any of these other people. It was definitely a moment where I wanted to make sure the chirps were a little louder in my ear through the book, and then wanted to address the fact that I felt very complicit in where we got to today, and making sure that people start talking about it and stop behaving as if this is some third rail issue that will go away, because it won't.
Okay, thank you. And James, as for you, what I find sometimes a bit surprising is that we focus a lot on this question on censorship, but I don't know, for example, like, everyone listening to this podcast on their Apple device, which will have the mention, like, designed in California, assembled in China. I'm just wondering, like, we will criticize the studio or the NBA for bowing, but yet at the same time, like, it seems like a lot of private companies, by making a buck in China, at the end you help growing China GDP and everything that goes along with it. So I'm wondering if sometimes, like, some type of issues have more publicity than other, but at the end of the day, I'm sure, like, some private companies, they brought so much money to this country that, well, later on, like, we know where the money is going to be used.
That's interesting. Obviously, we focused in this report on Hollywood because we're a cultural and free expression organization. And so that was a logical place for us to be. And we've done, as mentioned, other reports on digital media censorship, as well as translations of non-Chinese authors into Chinese language and the censorship that happens there. I mean, we focus on censorship because we're an anti-censorship organization. But certainly you bring up a really interesting question, and it relates on some level to what I mentioned earlier, which is the question of, especially for information or communication technology groups or entertainment groups or cultural groups, you know, when you engage with a country that has a rigorous centralized censorship system, such as China, evaluating whether the cultural communication you bring with you is outbalances or is outbalanced by any complicity with censorship you may have to have by doing so. And that's it's a regulatory question. It's a philosophical question. At the end of the day, on some level, it boils down to being an individual ethical question. You know, it's why I applaud Chris for being willing to turn his view inward in his book and grapple with some of the free expression implications of exactly what he's talking about and his participation in it. Moreover, it's why for Hollywood specifically, it's one of the reasons we need action from industry. If this is a professional ethical issue, then it should be industry actors who give out ethical guidance on how professionals should react to it.
I thought about this question because at the end of the report, I think it's basically the last paragraph, you have like this producer who complains about capitalism, and this for him, that's the entire reason why this conversation is happening.
Yeah, the quote was something like, you know, we're quick to point fingers, but it was American capitalism that initiated this whole thing, which does help, you know, illustrate some of the dynamics. And I think we have to think about the fact that it is primarily the Chinese government's massive economic leverage that it is able to bring to bear as the sole gatekeeper towards the nation's, at this point, you know, largest or about to become the largest box office in the world. That, at the core of it, is where Beijing's power to influence Hollywood comes from. And that's an economic question that is as related to Chinese censorship as it is related to American capitalism.
Okay, great. Then I'm wondering if each of you could recommend a film that has been influenced and censored by Beijing.
I have one that's been behind me in television interviews. It's a movie poster because I actually like the movie itself. It's the reboot of Point Break. It's a funny story because even though we got it into China, and we actually made more money in China than I think it made anywhere else in the world, we did create a scene that was ultimately censored. We created it to make it more exciting to China, but the CCP rejected the scene and said if we used it, we wouldn't get the movie in. And the scene was this. On the top floor of a 150-story gleaming glass building across the river from the Bund in the Pudong district of Shanghai, on the very top floor is a diamond dealership. And our Robin Hood characters in the Point Break movie take the freight elevator up to the 150th floor. It opens. They drive out super fast, knocking with hammers all the glass displays holding the diamonds, and grab as many diamonds as they can as they drive faster and faster towards the other side of the building. Where are they going? There's nowhere else to go. Oh, except they keep going and they break through the windows of the 150th floor of these buildings. No, do they die? Absolutely not. They have parachutes, and they parachute across the river over the Bund, flying over a market with peasants, and they drop the diamonds from 1,000 feet above because they are Robin Hood characters, and all the peasants collect the diamonds, and everything is happy. Well, the CCP did not like that action scene. It was a fantastic action scene that we kept in the movie, but they did not like it for two reasons. Number one is motorcycle guys driving through the top floor of a diamond dealership in Shanghai would have been caught before they got to the windows. And even if they did get out, no Chinese peasant would ever grab a diamond that was not theirs. So it's completely unrealistic.
Well, so I would take the diamond.
I would take the diamond. Fascinating. The movie that I would pick, The Meg, which came out in 2018. It was a U.S.-China joint production. Jason Statham, Li Bingbing. It was loosely based off a novel that set the events of the book in Japan, and the movie, presumably because it was joint production, that the movie's events are relocated to the off the coast of China. And I think it's worth mentioning relocating a movie setting from Japan to China, from one place to another, is not a free expression issue. But we want to, and we try to do this in the report, peel back and look at the context and the why. So it's not like we're saying, well, don't set movies in China. That's obviously not where we're trying to take this point. But it's about really thinking about, you know, the rationale for the decisions that are made and how they're being influenced and who's influencing them. We talk about in the report, it was so favorable in its treatment of China that that there were netizens who were saying, well, this is such a thoughtful shark. This is a pro-China shark. But the reason I'm recommending it is quite simply, I liked the movie. I love a good shark movie, and I thought it was great to see Jason Statham fight a shark. You know, you can always make a good popcorn flick, and we refrain in the report from making any type of kind of judgment on the merit or the technical quality of the movie. There are movies that we talk about in the report that I enjoyed watching as movies, and this is not to say that such movies don't have artistic or theatrical merit, but it's to peel the curtain back and to reveal how some of these decisions are made, why they're being made, and how the figure of the Beijing censor overall is exerting this influence on Hollywood as an industry that's directing it more towards the stories, themes, plots, and narratives that the Chinese government is interested in telling, and away from the themes, plots, and narratives that they think either directly or indirectly cast aspersions on them. And overall, that's really a concerning thing, because it's bending the world's most significant storytelling industry to the will of a government that doesn't hesitate to implement broad-based censorship.
Okay, great. I think now we can just finish with the quiz. So the rules are pretty simple. I will ask a couple of, three questions, maybe four. First question. In 2015, a Chinese television show got a lot of heat from the authorities for one reason. And then what happened is that they had to do a lot of recuts. This TV series is called With the Empress of China. It was broadcasted on Hunan TV. Can you tell me what was the main issue?
I don't know. That's television. That's
exactly. I'm going to strike out on that one.
Okay, there is Fan Bingbing in it. Maybe right. That could help a little bit.
What did she have tax issues? And they had to cut her out of the series?
No, not that.
Uh-oh, this is going to take away from everything we talked about for the last hour and a half. Listeners are going to be like, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Thank goodness we can say, oh, it's a show, it's not a movie.
I don't know the answer, Aladdin.
Okay, so the answer is that actually some of the actresses, they were having too much cleavage, so then they had to recut all of it so that you don't see the cleavage of the actress.
Okay.
Hopefully the next one will be easier for you. Can you tell me whose Marvel Comics character, place of birth, and sex got changed?
Oh, that's James. It's yes. The ancient one, this major supporting character in the film Doctor Strange, and Robert Cargill, who was involved in the movie, talks about how part of the rationale he believes was the idea of not upsetting either Chinese audiences or the Chinese government by depicting a Tibetan character, which is one example that's commonly described as a major example of the type of censorious pressure we're talking about.
Exactly. Malaysia and Vietnam had an issue with a Disney film. Can you tell me its name and what?
Abominable. They depicted what in the map scene in the movie, they depicted what's called the Nine Dash Line, which is essentially China's territorial claims over the South China Sea. And China's neighbors vociferously objected. And of course, that issue has actually been arbitrated by an international tribunal, and the decision went against China. However, even so, the film, which was a joint production, shows essentially China's political perspective over who controls that area.
Okay, great.
I'm going to have a hard time. This guy is Duke undergrad and a Harvard Law School degree. I barely got out of Cornell Engineering, so...
Yeah, but you've been in the business and in China for many years. Come on. Okay, well, on those good words, we'll wrap up the show. So thank you guys for your time. And thank you, dear listeners, to stay until the end credits.
Thanks for having us, Aladdin.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And yes, dear listener, at the really end, my mic had a battery issue, but fortunately, that's why if you do podcasting, you should always have a backup recording in order to finish the show. Middle Earth is produced by China Compass Production, your production service in the Middle Kingdom. In case you have a cultural project related to China, drop us an email at chinacompassproduction.com and see how we can help. Today's episode was produced by Aladdin Faré,
co-produced by Kaiser Guo,
music by Sean Calvo,
design by Brendan Gonzalez.
And please, if you like Middle Earth, do consider sharing your favorite episode to one of your friends. Always help with the algorithm and our ego. And if you do, you might earn a free month at OVTV. Hope to see you next time and stay safe. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and I don't know if I could win the quiz either. I mean, James has got quite an education behind him that I don't think I can compete with.
No, I'm liking your chances, Chris.
Okay.